Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. At least 36 million people in the U.S. have lost their jobs due to the coronavirus pandemic. Almost 40% of U.S. households earning less than $40,000 a year lost their jobs in March. These are disproportionately households of color. Even before COVID, those households struggled to make ends meet, and this crisis has just made it worse. Unemployment numbers have soared to their highest level since the Great Depression. Food banks are struggling to keep up with demand as people wait in line for hours to feed their families. Nurses and frontline workers are still demanding personal protective equipment like masks. Advocates say we cannot go back to normal once we get through this pandemic. It is time for a 21st century post-COVID New Deal. And that is what we're talking about today. What should that look like? How should a post-COVID New Deal tackle issues like inequality, poverty, and the climate crisis? Today, we are joined by Gray Brecken and Richard Walker, board members of the Living New Deal. It's a project that makes the legacy of the New Deal visible and educates Americans about what is possible when government is dedicated to the public good. Gray Brecken is the founder of the Living New Deal. He's former vice president of the National New Deal Preservation Association and author of Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. Gray regularly lectures around the country about the New Deal legacy, and he's president of the Living New Deal nonprofit board of directors. Hi, Gray. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Not quite correct. I'm not the president. I'm the project scholar for the Living New Deal project.
Thank you for that correction. Great to hear your voice, Gray.
Thank you, Rose.
We are also joined by Richard Walker, director of the Living New Deal. Richard is professor emeritus of geography at UC Berkeley and author of many books, including his latest, Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. And we had Dick Walker on the show a couple of times talking about that book. Hi, Dick. Welcome back to the show. Great to have you.
Hi, Rose. Always good to be here.
Well, I want to start off by talking about where we are today. According to Johns Hopkins, almost 1.4 million people in the United States have tested positive for COVID-19. And, you know, when you sit back and think about these numbers, it's so tragic. Right now, 84,313 people have lost their lives. And Gray, I feel like we haven't really taken the time as a country to really acknowledge and mourn all of these deaths. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's correct, Rose. This is an extraordinary crisis that we're facing with an almost malignant lack of leadership at the top. I mean, I liken it to President Roosevelt delegating authority to the states after the attack on Pearl Harbor. You can imagine what a cock-up that would have been. But what we need, obviously, is strong and scientifically based leadership at the very top, and we're certainly not getting it. The CDC is one of the world's most prestigious medical bodies, and it's been almost entirely sidelined. You just don't hear about it. If we had actually had the kind of leadership that the CDC used to have, those 84,000 people would not be dead now.
Mm. What would you add, Dick?
Well, I think the response, of course, has been ghastly. And the health crisis is, everybody knows how bad it really is. And what we need is some kind of a definite positive response from the federal government, which is what we had when Franklin Roosevelt took over. But we're still in the Herbert Hoover stage here. And Hoover dawdled for 4 years while the Great Depression got worse and worse, and which, of course, helped Roosevelt get elected and may help us get a better person elected again. But then Roosevelt, when he came in, he stepped up immediately and started doing things like creating the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, the Federal Emergency Relief Act, and the National Recovery Act, things immediate responses to get the economy moving, to deal with the crisis, to help people, to help bail out state government finances and so on. And that's what we're not seeing. We're seeing some of that at the state level, but none of that at the federal level, except from Congress. But I'll talk more about that, because I think just throwing money at the problem is not going to be enough.
Well, I also want to mention this morning, Dr. Rick Bright testified before the House Committee on Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health. And last month, he was removed as director of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority after he resisted efforts to increase access to hydroxychloroquine, the anti-malarial drug that was pushed and promoted by Donald Trump. This morning, Dr. Bright said, quote, "Our window of opportunity is closing. If we fail to develop a national coordinated response based in science, I fear the pandemic will get far worse and be prolonged." He said, "Without clear planning and implementation of the steps that I and other experts have outlined, 2020 will be the darkest winter in modern history," end quote. Gray, we've been talking about this on the show, that there just really is no national plan still.
That's right. There's just, as I said, a malignant vacuum at the very top. And I can't lay all the blame on this president, although I think I would like to. But the grounds for this catastrophe have been prepared over decades now because of the defunding of what we once had as a public health system. The New Deal put an enormous emphasis on health in its broadest possible dimension, including mental health. And part of that is because of Roosevelt's own personal experience with a catastrophic disease himself, that is polio, which we don't have to worry about anymore, largely because of Roosevelt and the research that went into finding the Salk and Sabin vaccines to make sure that we don't have to worry about that anymore. But at the same time, what the New Deal did was to build 5,300 hospitals, including rural hospitals around the country, many of which are now closing or radically understaffed. And that's exactly the areas to which the virus is now headed, especially in the South and in the Midwest. And they are very, very unprepared for what is about to hit them. But so much of that infrastructure, as well as the staffing, was provided during the Great Depression because of New Deal initiatives.
Well, let's go back then and talk about this, because we know about the problems that we're facing now. I mean, nurses today, what is the date? May 14th. They're still asking for masks. Frontline workers are still demanding masks. I mean, I talked about the lines at the food banks. Food banks have never seen such long lines of cars waiting for hours. So we know the problems that we're facing right now. Let's talk about what we can learn from what led to the New Deal when we talk about what a post-COVID New Deal would look like today. So we have time, luckily, on this show to really go over this. Dick, why don't you start? Let's talk about what really led to the New Deal.
Well, what led to the New Deal was the Great Depression. The economy went into a nosedive like it has today. And over a four-year period from late, 3.5 years from late 29 through early 1933, economic activity just went down, down, down. It wasn't just that the stock market collapsed. The banks started collapsing until about a third of the banks went under, taking people's savings with them. The stock market itself and other financial markets went down by 80-90%, wiping out an enormous amount of wealth. And, of course, employers started laying people off, cutting wages, which undermined total aggregate spending. So the economy just spiraled on down until by early 1933, GDP had fallen, that is, and national output had fallen by almost 50%. Employment had fallen by a quarter, so 25% unemployment. And really, underemployment and falling wages made the whole thing much worse. So you had enormous desperation. You had people taking to the road with no food. It was like today, long lines waiting for any food, any relief at all. So it was absolutely catastrophic. And I think because it took a little longer for it to unroll, people saw, could sort of understand the collapse of the economy better. Today, it's just gone off a cliff. I mean, you've just gone into this induced coma, as it were, in which everything is, so much of the economy, maybe a third of the economy, maybe more, has just stopped functioning suddenly. But it's quite comparable in that way. And what the New Deal, by the time Roosevelt came in, he knew he had to act. People were absolutely desperate. And that's what he did. And that's, of course, what we have to do today.
Gray, can you talk about the political climate back then? What really stands out for you?
Well, yes, you know, the 1920s, the so-called Roaring Twenties, was a time of just almost limitless speculation and corruption, which led to the market crash of 1929 in the fall of 1929. And many people think that the Great Depression started at that time. In fact, actually, the farmers were already in depression before that. They were in terrible shape. But the sadism of the Great Depression was that it actually it took about almost 5 years to get to the point where it was when Roosevelt came into office in March of 1933, and it kept lurching downhill for those years, so that whenever it appeared to be coming back, people would put their money into the market, and then it would go down again. But as Dick said, what's not comparable is that we have, that took, as I said, almost 5 years. What's happened now has happened in the space of about 2 to 3 months. And we are getting to Great Depression levels of unemployment and economic stress. At the same time that we're battling this terrible disease, at the same time with an almost total lack of leadership. And the other thing I must say is that Roosevelt had an astonishing charisma. He inspired confidence and courage in Americans, largely through his fireside chats, but also because of his bold initiatives in the Democratic-controlled Congress at that time. What we're seeing today is, instead of that kind of bold leadership and the kind of friendly courage that and optimism that Roosevelt conveyed at a time when it was so needed, is what we're seeing is venomous attacks on the president's perceived enemies instead of that kind of leadership. So people are rightfully confused and fearful, in fact, actually terrified, because they're not having the kind of leadership and confidence that the president inspired during the Great Depression. So we're going into perhaps a greater depression with exactly the opposite of the kind of leadership that the United States had at that time. And that's terrifying.
Well, and the other problem is that, and a lot of people point to Reagan when we talk about when things really shifted, when you had the anti-tax activist Grover Norquist say, "I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub." And so, Gray, now you have people who have no expectations of government and have outright hatred of government.
Yes. Actually, Paul Krugman wrote a wonderful column about that a few years ago called Hating Good Government. Yes, people have been encouraged to hate government itself, which is a very dangerous situation if you claim to be a democracy. Roosevelt always spoke of, when he spoke to the American people, he spoke in the first person plural. It was always we and us rather than me or I. It wasn't competitive, it was cooperative. And that was the spirit of the New Deal, very, very different from where we are today, where, for example, a situation has been set up where the states are actually competing against one another and the federal government for the protective equipment that they need. That would have been inconceivable at that time. So it's pitting people against one another, a kind of idealized version of Tombstone, Arizona, or Dodge City, you know, which is, I guess, what Ayn Rand encouraged her followers to idealize. But I've often wanted to have a time machine to send them back to those Wild West towns to see how they would like it, especially like it without things like sewers, for example, clean water, adequate food and drug safety, et cetera, all the things that we've come to take for granted, largely because they were put in place during the New Deal. One of the things we have done in mapping the New Deal and exploring it is to find out how water systems and, well, public health in general, but the enormous amount of sewers that were laid at that time, the sewage treatment plants, and the clean water that was provided to people. People didn't, they couldn't take that for granted before the New Deal. After it, in fact, actually, everybody began taking it for granted. It sort of goes back to, as I said, polio. We've largely forgotten about polio because that was largely taken care of by the vaccines that were developed as a result of initiatives started under Franklin Roosevelt.
Dick, can we also spend some time talking about the social movements that also made the New Deal possible? There was a very powerful coalition of labor unions combined with communist parties and socialist parties. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think sometimes we on the left romanticize a bit the popular movements, which were pretty dead at the by the late 1920s. The capitalists had defeated labor pretty decisively. A lot of the movements were dead in the water. And what's important about Roosevelt and the New Deal is that not only did the Depression energize people because of the desperation, but there was a kind of reciprocity back and forth between the New Deal as a whole, and Roosevelt in particular, and the development of the popular movement. So, for instance, one of the first things they did was the National Recovery Act, which had a very important clause in it that legalized union organizing. And so the unions could say, could go out, organizers could now say, you know, the president wants you to get organized. The government's on your side. And union organizing really took off from the combination of the economic desperation and the sense that the government had changed and was behind labor. Now, it wasn't always behind labor. I don't want to romanticize this. But there was a kind of back and forth. And so the unions started to rebuild very dramatically. Of course, the industrial unions, the CIOs, started to get organized out of the AFL, which was more conservative at the time. And as they grew, they backed Roosevelt. They saw that the New Deal was doing things like ensuring, guaranteeing union hiring for public works projects, fair wages, was employing people, desperate people, through the CWA and the CCC and these other agencies. And so they started to back Roosevelt very strongly, so that by 36, he received the greatest plurality of all time in a presidential election. So these things really feed off each other. And Roosevelt, it wasn't just that he was optimistic, but he brought in a bunch of really smart old progressives like Harry Hopkins and Harold Ickes and Francis Perkins, who knew how to run agencies. They were really competent, were really devoted to the idea of serving the people and not just getting the economy back on its feet, but actually serving the people, helping the people. So then they started to pour money into, like I said, relief, started employing people in the CCC, for instance, and create the Soil Conservation Service to go out and help the in the Dust Bowl, because they had that kind of natural disaster. Natural disasters like in California, there was a 1933 Long Beach earthquake, and so many of the schools were destroyed in Southern California. So Ickes seized on that and stepped in with the Public Works Administration, and they rebuilt over 300 schools in the next 3-4 years in California. So, and people could see that this this administration was working on their behalf. And that was really important in developing that mutual support. So you did start from a position in the 20s of apparent defeat of the labor movement, apparent, you know, live for the moment, to get rich quick, the same kind of attitudes we've seen for the last 30, 40 years here today. And it's amazing how quickly it could turn around with the right leadership and the right action, you know, because it isn't just a matter of declaring policies or having a really attractive candidate or appealing candidates or whatever. It's also getting to work. And if there's one thing the New Dealers did is they rolled up their sleeves and they got to work, and people could see that. And that brought people around to the idea that the federal government was essential, was really the only thing that could pull you out of something that dire as the Great Depression. And that's true today. The states just can't do it by themselves, even California, for all its size. And certainly private enterprise is incapable of this, just can't do the job. The only thing that can really save us is the federal government.
Gray, what would you add
to what Dick just said? There's also a lack of something that we've come to take for granted, and that's scandal and graft. This gigantic public works project, which was designed to put people to work, was carried out with virtually no scandal. And that's because of what Dick said, that Roosevelt brought into his administration people who were extremely competent administrators, but also they were scrupulously honest. And so there's evidence, actually, that the kind of scandals and corruption that we've been seeing, actually, is deliberate, because it's meant to make people even more cynical about the functioning of a government and want it even less.
Right,
I think,
and
it's really important, the selling
ahead,
of what you're... I'm sorry, the selling of what you're doing. For instance, Governor Newsom, who's been pretty competent here, and I think the state government of California, we can be relatively proud of what it's been doing so far, and up to the limits of its competence. But I see two things that immediately come to mind. One is, for example, he wants to hire several thousand, maybe tens of thousands of people to do tracking and testing. You know, they're going to train the people, unemployed people, to come in and help with the public health crisis. Well, there's a branding issue here. I mean, it would be very smart to call it a public health corps and really, you know, create a clear image that the state is stepping in to do certain definite things to address the health crisis. And, you know, you have to sell government policies. It isn't enough just to do the right thing. It is also about politics. And the people need to understand that Newsom is making these positive moves. Now, of course, he's limited because California is going to run a deficit this year of about $50 billion. And state governments don't have the power to print money. They can go into debt, which we will do, and that's okay. But it's the federal government that has that unique power of creating money, of taking on immense deficits. And FDR and the New Deal was the first great experiment in peacetime deficits to address a crisis in what later became called Keynesian economics. And without that kind of money, that short-term aid that the New Deal provided to salvage bankrupt state and city governments, all our local governments are going to be up against the wall very quickly.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking with Richard Walker and Gray Brecken. They are part of the Living New Deal. It's a project that makes the legacy of the New Deal visible and educates Americans about what's possible when government is dedicated to the public good. We're talking about the New Deal. We're also going to talk about what a post-COVID New Deal should look like, and we would love to hear from you. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, please call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll speak with independent journalist Todd Miller about his book, Empire of Borders, the expansion of the U.S. border around the world. He traces the United States' role in the rise of the global border regime and how borders pit transnational elites against the world's poor. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's show, so many people are saying we cannot go back to normal. We have to come up with bold new plans because, as we talk about on this show on a regular basis, we have solutions to so many of our problems. The problem is the political will. So what would you like to see in a post-COVID New Deal? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Gray Brecken, founder of the Living New Deal, Richard Walker, director of the Living New Deal. It's a project that makes the legacy of the New Deal visible and educates Americans about what's possible when government is dedicated to the public good. We have an email from Greg. He says, when the Republicans say as their religious mantra, government cannot work, even after they're elected to run the government, and if they are absolutely committed ideologically to this principle as they govern, that the very institution they're charged with running on behalf of the people to the best of their ability are committed to its very destruction, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Can your guests please comment on this?
Yeah, I'd like
Gray,
to
do you want to take that first?
Oh, okay.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I think Dick wants to, so I'm going to toss to him on this one.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it's self-fulfilling on the Republican side in an absolutely ghastly way, in which they've undermined government, as we said earlier, and then take charge and they're incompetent. So it just reinforces the idea that the government can't help. But it can work the other way for the progressive side, and that's what it did in the New Deal. If you start taking action and employing, creating jobs programs, investing in the country with public works programs and public health programs, people start to see the results. And a very important dimension of the New Deal was it was very practical. It wasn't just big laws like Social Security or stabilization through national recovery or price control. No, it had these very practical jobs programs like the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Work Progress Administration, the Civil Works Administration, the National Youth Administration that went to work, and people could see it in communities across the country. Every county in America had these kind of programs. They could see the local people getting hired. They could see investment in public works from sewers to city halls to schools to gymnasiums to parks and so on. And that made it clear that the government was working for them. And I have to say, I want to answer, we'll come around to this, but the earlier question that you posed, Rose, about what's the long-term situation here? And it's really dire. This is not a short-term crisis that we're just going to leap right back out of and go to work again. It's being badly underestimated by a lot of business, a lot of people, and certainly by our government. how quickly this economy can bounce back. And a lot of economists around the world, including, you know, those at the IMF and other major international conservative mainstream bodies, are saying this is going to be another Great Depression. It's going to go on for a long time. So how are we going to respond? And that's what the other thing the New Deal did. It just wasn't short-term response. They started these programs that were long-term investment in rebuilding the country, making a comprehensive change to transition. We need to transition to a green economy, transition to a comprehensive health system, rebuild our education, school system. And those are the things that we can start thinking about. Maybe in the short run, the next 2-3 months, you can throw money at simply getting checks to people so they don't starve, so they can pay the rent and so on. But in order to get this economy going again, you're going to have a long-term plan, a New Deal type plan on a number of fronts that's going to re-employ workers, because unemployment is now, effective unemployment is actually not 14%, it's over 20% already. It may be already 25% in real terms. So this is the time to start thinking about how are you going to employ those people who aren't going to be rehired by an economy that's been dealt an absolutely stunning blow.
And can I also say that in answer to that question, that I was struck by something that Dr. Bright said this morning at the hearing. He started out by saying that he's dedicated his life to public service. And what the situation we're in now is the result of a 40-year war on the very idea of the public in all of its dimensions, the public domain, but especially public service, that under this president, you're a chump if you go into public service. But who are the people who are on the front lines? They are public servants who risk their lives every day. And so, of course, we honor them, but we have to remember they are dedicated to public service. And you're not a chump if you go into that. I think we realize now that those are the real heroes, the ones who actually put their lives on the line, just as much as the veterans of our wars are as well, too. But we have to honor the public because we've so gotten away from it. As Maggie Thatcher said, there is no such thing as society. And that has gotten us into the dire situation that we're in now.
Well, thank you for the email, Greg. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Stephen in Oakland. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hello. So I'd like to take issue with the trajectory of the labor movement and the left that was laid out. And, you know, I think that the contrast between the situation of the 30s and now in that respect is even more stark than the political scene. So, you know, one has to keep in mind that the people who were active during the 30s, those who were older in their 50s or 60s were born in 1870 or 1880, and then, of course, the younger was after the turn of the century. And, you know, it was mentioned that, of course, the decade of the 20s was somewhat of an eclipse of the labor movement. But, you know, you think about your own life and 10 or 11 years, why, you know, that's not the same as 30 or 40 years. And in fact, in terms of the militancy and class consciousness of the labor movement, we should even look to like 1947 as the beginning of a process of decline. But at any rate, you have to remember that generations that had attempted to develop industrial unionism and who had formed socialist and began communist parties was very much alive even and kicking, even though much depressed during the 20s, and all that sprang to life again. And of course, the three great general strikes in 1934, and that continuing labor offensive that was informed and infused by a real revolutionary class consciousness, despite the fact
Stephen,
that...
thank you for calling in. Gray or Dick, do you want to respond?
Yeah, Stephen's right, of course. I mean, there was a tremendous labor legacy and radical legacy that was essential to the development of this country and to the politics of the New Deal in the 1930s. I don't want to dismiss that. But I think we, we could just despair that the labor movement has been so defeated over the last 50 years, that the ideological victory of the right is so great that we can't do anything. But I'm unwilling to give into that despair. And I think while the caller is right, Stephen's right, that you have to rebuild the labor movement. Without the working class organizations, people are very lost. And we see that in the number of people who can imagine that Trump was their friend or turned to neo-fascism and so on. You have to have a strong labor movement. We have to rebuild it. We need the laws to do that. And that's part of the job that has to be done. Don't get me wrong. But I think we can do it. I think we have an immense reservoir of very sophisticated labor organizers and unions, especially in California today, who know what they're doing and know what's needed. And we have a lot of old lefties like us hanging around, Stephen, who with lots of good ideas on every front, whether it's green policies or health policies or international policies. There's a lot of wisdom there accumulated over the last few decades. So I refuse to give in to despair. And I think if you can get a government with some leadership and with sensible ideas, we can go far. And I'm encouraged by the fact, for instance, that the Bernie people and the Biden people are working together to create policy teams. I just saw an article on that today in the news. And get intelligent, good policies mapped out that include progressive elements. And that's going to make a huge difference if the Democrats win. Because as we know, it's not enough just for the Democrats to win and Trump to lose. We have to have definite policies and good people to get things moving again.
And that's, of course, part of what the New Deal is all about. It's to remind people that we don't have to live in dystopia, that there once was a very different path that we were on. So I encourage people to go to the Living New Deal website. You'll learn an awful lot there.
Yeah, it really is an amazing project. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Sadiqa that's related. Do your guests think that Joe Biden could possibly create and oversee a new deal like this one? Roosevelt was not dependent on the richest 1% for campaign funds. Neither were the Democrats at that time. Most of our congressional Democrats today are. Biden has been anointed as the future president. Sadiqa writes, if, as I fear, he is simply not up to the job, what then?
Dick?
Who'd like to take that?
Well,
Dick?
Yeah, it's easy to be discouraged, I have to admit. And we, all of us on the left, know how dire the situation is. We may not know how dire the economic situation is, but I think we're pretty well informed about the problems with the politics of the Democratic Party. It's not good. They've been neoliberalized for years, moved to the center under the influence of the Clintons. Obama was right smack in the center, a good neoliberal. And despite his victories, we didn't get much done. Nothing much was done, and that made the problems worse. But I think this time around, people are really waking up to the importance of government action. The government vacuum at the top is so telling. The importance of workers, what we now call essential workers, the working class, as we used to call it. And hopefully hopefully the movements, and we see a lot of bubbling movements around the country, will propel a more radical stance on the behalf of the on the part of the Democrats. I just have to be positive, because being defeatist is just not going to get us anywhere.
I will say that one thing that alarms me about centrists like Biden, Pelosi, Feinstein is they don't seem to understand yet that we're headed into another catastrophe, and that is, of course, climate chaos. I don't think that they really get it yet. Jay Inslee from Washington, the governor, he certainly understood that, and I'm sorry he dropped out so soon. But that's why we do need a Green New Deal. And again, the Living New Deal is a great place to go to find out how Green New Deal 1.0 was, so that we can learn from what they did. There were enormous initiatives at that time that most people are almost entirely unaware of.
Well, thank you for the email, Sadiqa. Go ahead, Dick.
Well, you know, the old left slogan about socialism or barbarism, I mean, we can see that we're descending into a kind of barbarism. And as the climate crisis gets worse, things are really dire. I mean, again, I hope people on the left are pretty well informed by now about how bad the climate crisis is, how much global warming, the effects of global warming, how dire they're going to be. So we don't need to reemphasize that. But, you know, in the U.S., there really was that choice in the 30s, because there was a lot of fascism and fascist sympathizers active in the country, fascist rallies, right-wing figures like Father McLaughlin and so on. And
William Randolph Hearst.
Indeed. And Roosevelt, the New Deal turned that around. So I think, you know, that the left has always been a bit too critical of the New Deal, which for its shortcomings, definitely, on quest, you know, it saved capitalism for sure. But it also saved democracy. And in that sense, it was not socialism or barbarism, but a Green New Deal or barbarism today. If we don't get a Green New Deal, I think we're in extremely bad shape, and politics will only devolve worse to the right.
I just want to spend, before we end, what's I think exciting about the Green New Deal is that so many young people are involved in this. And just thinking about where young people are today, straddled with so much debt, going into a really horrible job market. You know, if they live in a place like the Bay Area, the rents are so incredibly high. The Sunrise Movement, these young environmentalists on the front lines, young indigenous activists, I mean, they're calling for a people's bailout to save jobs, putting employees back on payroll during this crisis, providing $2,000 a month to everyone so they can pay their bills. Can you both talk about just the how so many youth are really on the front lines of this today?
Well, I gave a talk at the Exploratorium last year on just this topic with some of the people from the Sunrise Movement. And usually when I give talks about the New Deal, the demographics skew upwards. They are older people. And I was really encouraged when I went there because it was largely younger people. And they were astonished to hear the kind of initiatives that happened during the 1930s, of which they're almost entirely unaware. So they're sort of bending around the name of the New Deal without knowing very much about what it did and what we could learn from it, particularly the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was an army of a peacetime army of 3.5 million young men, many of them in terrible health when they went in, starving, illiterate. And they absolutely transformed the country in the 10 years of the CCC's existence. And we have so much to learn from them. They planted 3.5 million trees. That's a lot of carbon sequestration. So, but that also brings up the fact that these are forgotten civilian armies that we had. And one of the reasons that it's going to be impossible to pay for a new New Deal is our military budget. And until we begin to demilitarize and take the money that's being squandered in trying to maintain a global empire and put that into domestic expenditures, like happened during the 1930s, it's going to be almost impossible to finance something that ambitious.
Mm. You know, I'm really encouraged by what I see, actually, from young people, because the scales have fallen from their eyes. They realize that the country is in deep doo-doo, and that their lives are really imperiled, their prospects, their careers are really imperiled, and they were seeing that even before the economy fell off the cliff with the coronavirus crisis. And I think one of the most encouraging things is how the shibboleths fall away as the crisis gets worse. And you suddenly see rather conventional politicians in the Senate, of all places, like this Republican from Missouri and so on, saying, my God, you know, we have to give people money. We have to pay their salaries directly in this interim so that they can survive. So that the ideological veil that has been clouded our vision and a lot of people's vision is starting to fall away as the crisis deepens. And that makes a lot of things possible that we couldn't imagine even 6 months ago, and maybe can't imagine even right this minute.
Well, we have a question about teaching this to young people. Let's hear from Julie in Oakland. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for your wonderful show at all times and your warm voice.
Thank you.
I'm a teacher in a high school, and I just want to say that if there's anyone out there who is in a position to help form curriculum, I mean, I'm inspired by it because I'm a special ed teacher. I push into general ed classes. And there's an old guy who's about to retire who's wonderful, and he really teaches the students about what happened, just what we were all talking about, you know, the depression and the New Deal. So if there's anyone who is, because now with rethinking the curriculum with long-distance learning, there's so much opportunity to teach students what is what if it were offered, if it were created, mm-hmm. a visual, you know, exciting curriculum that could connect what's been and, you know, what could be. The students would get it. They get it. When it's explained to them. And so if there are people out there that could do this, I mean, I'm not in a position to, I don't, but I really want it. And I just want to put a call out there for people to think about reaching the students. You know, we talk about young people, but like they have to be educated properly.
Well, thank you, Julie. On the Living New Deal website, there are resources for teachers. There's films and videos. There's oral histories. Gray, what's your response to Julie?
Well, thank you. We do have that resource of curricula. We could put up more. We're always looking for it. What we've noticed is that visitations to the sites go up enormously towards the end of the semesters. And so we're finding that, in fact, we are the go-to site for students working on papers, and we're really heartened by that. And that's, of course, one of the reasons that we want to expand it even more. We have an enormous backlog of data. So at the present, if you go to the site, you'll see that we have over 16,000 New Deal sites around the country. But we know that there are hundreds of thousands more. And so we need to raise the funding so that we can actually hire the staff to begin catching up with this huge backlog that we have.
Anything to add, Dick?
Yeah, this is, I mean, one of the great problems is it's very practical, visible evidence of what the government, good government, can do when it cares about the people, when it invests in people, and when it has an ethical stance towards the public good. It's truly astounding. as Gray has said. And so much of it is forgotten. The New Deal, people have vague memories. Well, there was Social Security, and maybe there was this thing, the WPA, some relief work and so on. But it was absolutely immense, and it transformed the United States. It brought about a major economic shift, a political shift, governmental shift, rebuilt the potential of governments that we all lived off of for the next 50 years after the war. And a lot of the credit goes to World War II, which is mistaken because so much of the foundation was laid in the New Deal. And so I think the great lesson of our efforts is that it was done before, and by God, we can do it again.
Mm. And I also, you know, I called it the Living New Deal for a reason, and that's because it's all around us. It's just we don't see it. Dick and I are both geographers, and one of the things that geographers try to do is look at the landscape as a text. But most people are illiterate about some aspects of the environment, and they certainly are about the New Deal contributions. What we're teaching people to do is to read that text that they have been persuaded to forget or to be illiterate about.
Well, Gray and Dick, thank you so much for your work. And we have to continue this conversation because I really would like to spend more time talking about, you know, how the New Deal affected people who were very poor and low income. I mean, to think right now that 40% of households earning less than $40,000 a year lost their jobs in March, disproportionately households of color. I mean, we have to just continue talking about what sort of policies need to be in place because this just cannot continue. So, and I have to say, Dick, thank you for saying that. You have to still remain positive because, you know, change is possible. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you for having us. Love to come back again and talk some more.
All right. We would love that. Thank you. Gray Brecken and Dick Walker are members of the Living New Deal. They're board members. It's a project that makes the legacy of the New Deal visible and educates Americans about what is possible when government is actually dedicated to the public good. And you can find the Living New Deal website at our site, yourcallradio.org, and spend some time on this site. It's really amazing. There's films and videos. There's resources for teachers, oral histories, New Deal stories. It's just an incredible resource, the Living New Deal. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and I hope you can join us tomorrow. We'll speak with Todd Miller about his new book, Empire of Borders, the expansion of the U.S. border around the world. Thanks to Kevin Vance and David LaTulipe for keeping our studio going, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.